Hi, folks. Welcome to the Smartass Historian. I am, as always, the Great White Snark, Scotty J. Seated next to me is the Reverend Jeff.
Hallelujah. Glory. What do you say, brothers and sisters?
Right. Oh, man. I'm just happy to be on a couple of days off from work, man.
Oh, yeah.
Fuck, they've been running...
The Walton family treating you really good, are they?
Well, they are, but I mean, the problem is right now is, like, one day we had 7 call-offs.
Yeah, Walton or the fucking Adams family, one of the two.
But anyway, like, when daylight... When daylight savings time switched...
Pay no taxes.
We had 7 call-offs in the whole store. So what happened?
How many people are at the store at any given
time?
Oh,
God. I mean, when I walk in, overnights is... When I walk in at 4, the overnight crew is on their last 3 hours.
Because if that shit happened at, like, Taco Bell, people would be making their own fucking tacos.
Right. Well, no, I mean, we've got full crews in and everything, but when you lose 7 people...
It's like, today we're going to implement Make Your Own Damn Taco Day.
And now it'd be like, oh, you're going to put a fucking hurting on this son of a bitch. But, I mean, normally I top stock, which means I go in the back, I cap and bin the groceries back there on these huge racks. You know, I get my little scanner and I scan barcodes. And if it tells me it's got to go out, I throw it on my cart and I run it out. Well, when I came in work Sunday morning, they're like, I looked at my sheet and it was crossed off as like, dairy. I'm like, all right. I was in dairy all fucking day.
Like the it? Like it? The clown?
You're
dairy?
Right.
The town? Oh my God.
You know what? I was waiting for someone I knew to come in to the milk count case because I was back there stocking juices and be like, we all float.
Pennywise is gonna get Scott. Holy shit!
Yeah, I was gonna start if it was somebody that I knew that was coming up to buy milk.
Cause so you were Pennywise, a dancing clown. Pennywise, a dancing clown in dairy.
Yeah, I was. I'd put a red balloon out there on the doors and shit, but
I couldn't see like 8-year-old kids like freak the fuck out.
God, yeah, I'd laugh my ass off. I would. I would just sit there and laugh my fucking ass off. But, I mean, I was in... I was taking my lunches late that day. I took my last break at like a half an hour before I was scheduled to get out.
Yeah.
Well, no, it was like 12:15 I took my break. So I took my last break from 12:15 to 12:30. And that last half an hour, I was stocking milk since we're running a sale.
Stocking milk.
Yeah. Which I also call, you know, nailing a girl in a dairy cooler. Yeah. Stocking the milk.
Yeah.
Well, we got an interesting show for you today. We're going to talk about the patriarch of the Kennedy clan. Mr. Joseph Kennedy.
Joe Kennedy.
Yes.
What was that Al Bundy said at the nudie bar?
Something about, you know...
When something and there's a Kennedy on the floor at the nudie
bar. When there's a bouncer at the door and a Kennedy on the floor at the nudie bar. Now, Joseph Patrick Kennedy. That's a good Irish name for you.
Yeah.
He was born in Boston, Massachusetts. He was the elder son of businessman and politician Patrick Joseph P.J. Kennedy.
No, Jesus.
And Mary Augusta Hickey.
Oh, man.
Now, he had a younger brother, Francis, but Francis died young, and 2 younger sisters, Mary and Margaret. Those are Irish Catholic names right there, man.
Jesus, yeah.
I mean, I was raised Irish Catholic, and, you know, Mary, Margaret, and you might get a sister named Mary. I didn't go, there was no way they would have put me in a school that was run by nuns. I'd have been bounced in 5 minutes.
Yeah, you'd have had ruler marks on the back of your hands.
They would have been like, can you name the Holy Trinity? Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
Wrong Trinity. Nope. Not in my religion. That's my Trinity, sister. Who's your Trinity? Captain America, Iron Man, and Thor?
Corned beef, potatoes, and...
cabbage.
Yeah. There you go.
All four of Joe's grandparents had immigrated to Massachusetts in the 1840s to escape the Irish famine. Yeah, it's about the time mine came over.
Funny enough that when everybody eats corned beef and cabbage on St. Patrick's Day, that's not what the Irish would have actually eaten.
No.
That's an American thing.
Yeah.
It's stupid.
The Americans bastardized it, yeah. You know.
I can't remember what exactly would have been close. I was watching a show on it, and they were talking about it, and it, like, does not resemble anything. They wouldn't have had the money for corned beef.
Now, he was born into a highly sectarian society where Irish Catholics were excluded by the upper-class Boston Brahmins. Boston Irish lifestyle for the family, and as a result of his successful saloon business, investment ventures, and an influential role in local politics.
When are we going to talk about the guy that made the Pepperidge Farm?
Pepperidge Farm remembers. Remember that time you went to the free clinic and had that abortion?
Oh, God. I want to stop my face at Pepperidge Farm.
Now, his mother encouraged Joe to attend the Boston Latin School, where Kennedy was a below-average scholar but was popular among his classmates, winning election as class president and playing on the school basketball team. Or baseball, actually.
Baseball or basketball?
Baseball. You know how he was popular? He was bringing them booze. Hey, I have booze for you. Now, he followed in the footsteps of his older cousins by attending Harvard.
Harvard.
He focused on becoming a social leader, working energetically to gain admittance into the prestigious Hasty Pudding Club.
Hasty Pudding?
Yeah, it's like an elite club at Harvard.
Okay.
Now, while he was at Harvard, he joined the Delta Epsilon International Fraternity and played on the baseball team, but was blackballed from the Porcelain Club.
Uh-oh.
In 1937, he received an honorary degree in Doctor of Laws from Oglethorpe University.
All these words, I'm not understanding the Oglethorpe and...
It's a university.
Yeah, it's all Greek to me. All these weird places and stuff and I have never heard of before. Oglethorpe and Hasty Pudding and...
I might have to look up Hasty Pudding and do a show about it so you can know.
I don't know. I guess I don't know much about Boston.
I don't know that much about Boston either other than...
You baked
know,
beans. Boston baked beans other than and baked... Mike Wahlberg.
Right. The Wahlbergs.
And the car park. You see the car park? It's got car park.
Wasn't Cheers set in Boston?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe.
I was going to say, didn't he play for the Boston Red Sox?
I think
Sam did.
I think maybe. I don't know.
Because he brought Coach with him.
Yeah, I don't know. Now maybe we'll have to look at it.
Now, on October 7th, 1914, Kennedy married Rose Elizabeth Fitzgerald.
There's another one.
There's a good old Fitzgerald. The eldest daughter of Boston Mayor John F. Honeyfritz Fitzgerald.
Oh, Jesus.
Well, here's the thing. Honey Fritz was a political rival of his father's.
Oh, shit. I swear to God, you hit these people and like four-leaf clovers fall.
Leprechauns pop out of their ass. Now, the marriage joined the two of the city's most prominent political families. Now, Joe and Rose had 9 kids because they like to fuck, and Irish like to have many
and
kids.
They don't believe in birth control.
No. Oh, God,
as
no.
As a Catholic.
Well, no, my grandparents had 8 kids. Had 8 kids, 5, no. 6 survived to adulthood.
6?
Yeah, 6.
Well.
Yeah, they had 9 kids. Because Irish like big families.
Well, yeah.
Now, as Kennedy's business success expanded, he and his family kept homes in the Boston area, suburban New York City, Hyannisport, Massachusetts, and Palm Beach, Florida. Well, we always heard about the Hyannisport one, because that was the Kennedy compound in Hyannisport.
The Kennedy compound.
Now, Kennedy requested that surgeons perform a lobotomy on his eldest daughter, Rosemary, in 1941. Now, for various reasons for the operation to be given, but it left her permanently incapacitated.
Well, no shit, that's what it does.
Well, I mean, you can still function a bit, but no. Something happened with Rosemary's where she just became like a drooling vegetable.
Well, isn't that what a lobotomy does?
Like I said, many reasons have been given. The one that I heard that she was a little special, like special needs. Mm. To use the vernacular today, retarded. And, well, you can't have that in a good, upstanding family.
Yeah, back then, yeah, no. Definitely not, because then. Nowadays. Back then, they would put.
You were locked up in an institution.
Yeah, they'd put you in a nut hut or a sanatorium or
now,
whatever you want to call
nowadays
it.
Nowadays, you can have your retarded child run for president, and he might win.
Yeah.
Good. Very good.
Got the best brain.
Now. Sorry. Now, Rosemary died in 2005 at the age of 86. And her name was never mentioned in the house, according to Janet DeRozier, the Kennedy secretary and mistress of 9 years.
Yeah, because that's the family's dirty little secret.
Right. Now, Dr. Bertram Brown, director of the National Institute of Mental Health, said later that Joseph called his daughter Rosemary mentally retarded rather than mentally ill in order to protect John's reputation for a presidential run. And that the family's lack of support for mental illness is part of a lifelong family denial of what was really so.
Yeah, because mental retardation, they would just stick them in a...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In a... nut hut or, sanatorium back then. It just...
Yeah. You would go to, like...
A mental facility and they just...
A hospital and...
Yeah, and they just didn't... I mean, families didn't deal with it.
Well, and I had friends that had worked at, like, Shapiro and Good Shepherd Manor where some of those older families had put their mentally ill
now
relatives.
That shit is, like, unspeakable. You can't do that to somebody.
Well, no, but back then... See, what it was like, if you were a well-to-do family, you could put...
Well, no, even non-well-to-do families did that, too.
Right. Well,
I've seen it done, heard and seen it done.
Right, or they would either put them up in the attic or down in the basement and not talk about them.
I've seen that done too, but in like a horror movie. Like, oh my God, it's unchained, it's out of the basement!
Right. Get the broom, get the fish head bucket.
But like, oh, he lives in the walls, he's okay.
But, the families would put their mentally ill person over, like, say, Good Shepherd Manor in Moments. Okay?
Yeah.
Put them there, then they would come visit them once a year.
Or not at all.
Some cases, not at all. Some cases, mom and dad would come once a year, usually Christmas or their birthday, and visit.
Too much of a boy for boy, or too crazy for Boys Town, and too much of a boy for Crazy Town.
Right. God, we're finding uses for Sims has told the future.
Yeah.
I hate that shit. Now, Kennedy, yeah, I'm on the ball today. Kennedy pursued a career in business and investing upon graduation from college. Now, in his mid to late 20s, he made a large fortune as a stock market commodity investor and reinvesting in real estate and a wide range of business industries. Now, he never built significant business from scratch, but his timing as both a buyer and seller were unusually excellent. Sometimes he made use of inside information, in ways which were legal at the time but were later outlawed. Martha Stewart went to jail for shit like that, but Joe Kennedy didn't.
Well, no, because it wasn't a crime back then.
In fact, it was Kennedy who later assisted in outlawing the very manipulations he had once engaged in. Irma, gonna make this illegal?
Yeah.
Because I made Irma money off of it.
Yeah, we can't be having anybody else get rich how I got rich. You know?
Right. Now, in the course of his role on the SEC after President FDR had appointed him as its first chairman. So he becomes head of the SEC, and he's like, yeah, we're going to start outlawing the shit that made me rich.
I don't understand the insider trading. I mean, some of it can be categorized as illegal.
Mm-hmm.
But if you, like, hear, like, some stock is going to do good or something like that, you can't use the tip because that's insider trading. I think that's bullshit. I mean, you're just, it's not that you're doing any illegal activities. It's just that you heard, you know, it's like you hear a horse is faster than the other horses and you go to the horse track to bet on the sumbitch, you know, and it wins because you heard it was, you know, a really fast horse or whatever the hell.
Right.
And it's like, now you're going to arrest me for it? It's like,
right.
I don't know. Some of that insider trading is, or they manipulate shit and whatever. But yeah. I mean, just because you hear, I don't know. Okay, well, if you work in the trading, because it's called insider trading, duh.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you work and at the, you know, you're
trading, the stock market, yeah.
Yeah, if you're trading stock and you work at the stock market, yeah, I could see it as a, but if like, you're like a Joe Schmo, because Martha Stewart, she wasn't a stock market person.
No, but her broker gave her some information.
Oh. I thought she just come by, you know, like...
No, she
someone
was...
Someone told her, found out, you know, I didn't know that...
No, I think it was her broker gave her information on, like, some stocks that she had that weren't going to do good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but even, isn't that kind of his job, though?
You could kind of
say, hey, that's his job. And be like, don't invest in Sony. Invest in, you know, Samsung.
I don't know. I don't know. She got busted for it.
Yeah, I don't know. I just... It's all really, like...
It's
all really, like...
Murky.
Yeah, it's all, like, I got rich, but I don't want you getting rich that way.
Right.
It's all, you know... Like, kind of how, like... You can get rich by stealing money from poor people, basically, and duping poor people out of shit like many businesses have built their, you know, empires over. But if you take money from rich people, you're that's going to hell.
Right.
You know, you know, that's it. You're they're going to destroy you.
Okay.
That's just how I'm kind of, you know.
So after Kennedy's 1969 death, and only a week before his own death in 73, Brooklyn Mafia boss Frank Costello claimed to an author collaborator that he had been associated with Kennedy in bootlegging during Prohibition.
Frank Costello.
My boss. My boss in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
I think I have a script for him for Killers. If not, I'll have one. Now, to this day, as Kennedy's most recent and most thorough biographer David Nassau asserts, no credible evidence has been found linking Joe Kennedy to bootlegging activities. Now, when Fortune magazine published its first list of the richest people in the United States in 1957,
yeah,
it placed him in the 200 to 400 million group, which today would be 1.71 billion to 3.41 billion.
Jesus.
Meaning it estimated him to be between the 9th and 16th richest person in the U.S.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a big gap there.
Oh, here. Yeah.
Now, after graduating from Harvard.
Harvard.
In 1912 with an A.B. in economics, he took his first job as a state-employed bank examiner, allowing him to learn a great deal about the banking industry. In 1913, the Columbia Trust Bank, in which his father held a significant share, was under threat of takeover. Hmm. Now Joe, borrowing $45,000, which today would be $1,090,455,
Jesus,
from family and friends, bought back control and at the age of 25 was rewarded by being elected the bank's president. He told the press he was the youngest bank president in America. Now, he emerged as a highly successful entrepreneur with an eye for value. For example, as a real estate investor, he turned a handsome profit from ownership of Old Colony Realty Associates Incorporated, which bought distressed real estate. Hmm. He was a flipper.
Yeah. Gentrification.
Early gentrification. Yeah. Now, during World War I, President Woodrow Wilson asked the Intercontinental Rubber Company, which was owned by Bernard Baruch, J.P. Morgan, and Kennedy.
J.P. Morgan, really fun fact about him. J.P. Morgan's dad, when he was like 10 years old, brought in a package with like $1 million in it.
Oh, wow.
And, like, handed it to his 10-year-old son, and he said, I want you to feel this and feel how much it weighs.
Yeah.
This is $1 million. And he's like, you know, basically, like, started J.P. Morgan's appetite for money. Basically.
Right. What was his Pierpont? Yeah, Pierpont. Hmm. J.P. Morgan was some, I don't know what the J is, but the P was Pierpont.
Yeah, he basically was like, yeah, go out there and make your, you know,
oh, he
you know,
did.
Fortune. Yeah. Oh, yeah, well, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You can see well, we're gonna cover
him. Trust me, J.P. Morgan.
I was like, I heard that story. I was like, wow, that's messed up, you know.
Now, he asked him to grow guayule. Now, this is a plant that produces latex that can be used to make rubber. Latex rubbers.
Rubber man.
Now, many feared the German Navy might blockade rubber shipments from Asia. As a result, Intercontinental established a Continental farm in the little town of Continental in southeastern Arizona in 1916. The guayule growing operations didn't last, and in 1922, the farm was sold to Queen Wilhelmina of the Netherlands, who rented the fields to cotton farmers for several years. Now, although skeptical of American involvement in the war, Joe sought to participate in wartime production as an assistant general manager of the major Bethlehem Steel Shipyard in Quincy, Massachusetts. There, he oversaw the production of transports and warships. Through this job, he became acquainted with Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, FDR was a big Navy man.
Oh, yeah, I bet.
That's why our Navy grew under his president, you know, his administration. Because the man was Navy. Give me a boat. I want a boat. Now, in 1919, Joe joined the prominent stock brokerage firm of Hayden, Stone & Company, where he became an expert dealing in the unregulated stock market of the day, engaging in tactics that would later consider to be insider trading and market manipulation.
Here we go.
He happened to be on the corner of Wall and Broad Street at the moment of the Wall Street bombing on September 16, 1920, and was thrown to the ground by the force of the blast. 1923, he left Hayden and set up his own investment company. Now, Joe subsequently became a multimillionaire during the bull market of the 1920s, and even wealthier as a result of taking short positions in 1929. Hmm. Now, David Kennedy, who is no relation to Joe, he's the author of Freedom of Fear, described the Wall Street of the Kennedy era as a strikingly information-starved environment. Many firms whose securities were publicly traded published no regular reports or issued reports whose data were so arbitrarily selected and capriciously audited as to be worse than useless. It was this circumstance that had conferred such awesome power on a handful of investment bankers like J.P. Morgan, because they commanded a virtual monopoly of the information necessary for making sound financial decisions. Especially in the secondary markets, where reliable information was all but impossible for the average investor to come by, opportunities abounded for insider manipulation and wildcat speculation. Now, Kennedy formed alliances with several other Irish Catholic investors, including Charles E. Mitchell, Michael J. Meehan, and Bernard Smith. He helped establish a stock pool to control trading in the stock of glassmaker Libby Owens Ford, an arrangement to drive up the value of the pool's operators holding in the stock, and using insider information and the public's lack of knowledge. Pool operators would bribe journalists to present information in the most advantageous manner. Pool operators tried to corner a stock and drive the price up, or drive the price down with a bear raid. Now, Kennedy got into a bidding war for control of Yellow Cab Company. Now, Joe later claimed he understood the rampant stock speculation in the late 20s would lead to the market crash. Supposedly, he said he knew it was time to get out of the market when he received stock tips from a shoeshine boy.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, mister, shine your shoes? U.S. Steel's doing pretty good, sir. You might want to invest in it.
Yeah. Thanks, Timmy.
Right.
Here's a quarter.
And an extra quarter for the tip. Yeah. Oh, boy, sir.
I'm going to eat good tonight.
I can have a piece of pie. Now, he survived the crash because he possessed a passion for facts, a complete lack of sentiment, and a marvelous sense of timing. Bullshit. Now, during the Great Depression, Kennedy vastly increased his fortune by investing most of it in real estate. Well, no shit! You got farms going under, businesses going under, you got prime real estate to buy there, son!
Along with Fred Trump and all them.
Well, Fred Trump was marching with his Klan buddies.
I think the dad?
Yeah. Yeah, his dad.
You figured he would be developing New York City by now.
Or, he was doing it too, but he got busted at a Klan rally in the 20s.
Oh, shit.
Good people. All good people.
On both sides.
Now, in 1929, his fortune was estimated to be $4 million, which is equivalent to $55.8 million today.
Jesus.
By 35, his wealth had increased to $180 million, which is equivalent to $3.14 billion today.
Bam.
Now, he made huge profits from reorganizing and refinancing several Hollywood film studios.
Hollywood for the boys to come back.
Yeah, Hollywoodland. I think it was supposed to be the name of a housing development out there.
No, that's what the Hollywood sign used to say.
Yeah, you used to say Hollywoodland.
Hollywoodland, and then they got rid of the land part.
Well, an earthquake happened and dropped off the land.
Oh, yeah, I didn't know what actually happened.
Yeah, it was an earthquake. Now,
isn't that convenient?
Right. So, film production in the U.S. was much more decentralized than it is today, with many different movie studios producing film product. Now, one small studio was Film Booking Offices of America, which specialized in Western Westerns produced cheaply. Its owner was in financial trouble and asked Joe to help find a new owner. Kennedy formed his own group of investors and bought it for $1.5 million, which today would be about $20.5
million.
Now, he moved to Hollywood in March of 26 to focus on running the film studios. The studios were then permitted to own exhibition companies in which were necessary to get the films on local screens. Now, with that in mind, in a hostile buyout, he acquired the Keith Albee Orpheum Theater Corporation, which had more than 700 vaudeville theaters across the U.S. that had begun showing movies. Now, he later purchased another production studio called Pathé Exchange and merged these two entities with Cecil B. DeMille's Producers Distribution Corporation in March of 27. I'm ready for my close-up, Mr. DeMille. In August of 28, he unsuccessfully tried to run First National Pictures. In October of 28, he formally merged his film companies FBO and KAO to form Radio Keith Orpheum, or RKO Pictures, and made a large amount of money in the process. Then, keen to buy the Panagese theater chain, which had 63 profitable theaters, Kennedy made them an offer of $8 million, which today would be... Today it'd be $112 million.
Yeah.
It was declined. He then stopped distributing his movies to Panagese. Still, Alexander Panagese declined to sell. However, when Panagese was later charged and tried for rape, his reputation took a battering and he accepted Kennedy's revised offer.
Sure his last name wasn't Weinstein?
Well, Joe offered him $3.5 million, which today would be about $48.8 million. Now, Alexander, who claimed that Kennedy had set him up, was later found not guilty at a second trial. I know he raped a starlet. Now, James Roosevelt, who was the son of President FDR, helped Kennedy start his liquor business after Prohibition.
Of course.
It is estimated that Kennedy made over $5 million, which today would be $69.7 million, from his investments in Hollywood.
Man, they are up on the...
Yeah, the exchange.
Yeah, the exchange of the money. I'm like, holy cow, man, every time. Like, because usually we're sitting around going, I wonder how much that is in today's money. But today, they're just like, like banging on all cylinders, man.
Now, during his 3-year affair with film star Gloria Swanson, he was banging her? Goddamn, Gloria Swanson was a fucking fox back then.
I don't know who that is, but...
Well, I will pull up a picture real quick. Gloria Swanson was like a big name back then. Okay, let me get a picture here of her. That's her.
She's good looking, but that's like for kind of chick back in the day.
I mean, right, but she was banging Kennedy for 3 years.
Clean all the crap off of her and dress her in like today's clothes and you don't get any context with these. Yeah, she's pretty and everything. It's
right.
It's just hard to be like. I don't know. It's just too far removed
from us. Right.
Yeah. So it's like, yeah, she's pretty, but you know, I kind of see her as like old pictures of grandma, you know.
Right.
If you dressed her in today's clothes and I saw a picture of her, I'd be like, oh yeah, she's hot.
Now, during his 3-year affair, he arranged the financing of her films, The Love of Sonya and the ill-fated Queen Kelly, which now Sonya was made in 27 and Queen Kelly was in 28. The duo also used Hollywood's famous body sculptor, Masseuse Sylvia of Hollywood.
Body sculptor, huh?
Now, their relationship ended when Swanson discovered that an expensive gift from Joe had been charged to her account.
Uh-oh.
You're going to buy your mistress a gift but charge it to her? Well, that's to keep your wife from finding out, huh?
Yeah.
Fucking... So that's where John learned this shit from.
Yeah, but back then, they wouldn't, like... If you called, like, a company... A woman called a company to, like, find out information, they'd be like, where's your husband?
Right.
They'd be like, can I talk to your husband first? You know?
Right.
They're not going to offer up any information. I'm sure they wouldn't offer up any information.
Well, unless her...
Unless it's her account.
Yeah, it was her account, and I'm pretty sure... You know, with Hollywood, she had a financial advisor.
Yeah, probably.
Who probably went, Miss Swanson, I've noticed something discrepancies in your account.
But like, yeah, my account's getting bigger because I'm taking all your money.
Now, a reoccurring story about Kennedy alleges that he made his money in bootlegging. Although there is no hard evidence of this, he did have some extensive investments in the illegal importation of spirits after Prohibition ended. The bootlegging story itself may be traceable to a Canadian distiller, Samuel Bronfram, and to New England bootlegger Danny Walsh and his crime syndicate, which did in fact smuggle spirits across the Canada-US border during this period. Post-Prohibition, Bronfram had a bitter rivalry with Kenny in acquiring North American liquor distribution rights. That's how Capone did it over the Canadian border.
Yeah, but can it really be called, is it really smuggling when it's like, there's no, like, I mean, today, if you, like, had to smuggle the shit over the border, you're pretty good if you can get it over the border, but I mean, back then, it's like, you know, any little trick you can do,
any little trick you
fool
can get
them, you know,
right.
Now they've seen it all, you know.
Yeah, well, I know with, when I was a kid, I went to Capone's Northwoods hideout.
Mm-hmm.
And beautiful, beautiful house up on the up on this lake. And at the time that Capone owned it, he owned the land around the lake and the lake itself.
Yeah.
And he had a dock going out to the middle of the lake where seaplanes would come in from Canada loaded with liquor.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd have the trucks waiting on the dock for the liquor to come in. They'd unload the liquor, and he'd ship it down to Chicago.
Yeah, see, is it really called smuggling at that point? It's more like called logistics. You know? Or delivery, you know? I mean, come on.
Now, at the start of FDR's administration, Kennedy and Congressman James Roosevelt II founded Somerset Importers, an entity that acted as the exclusive American agent for Hag & Hag Scotch, Gordon's Dry Gin, and Dewar's Scotch. It is rumored that they had assembled a large inventory of stock, which they supposedly sold for a profit of millions of dollars when Prohibition was repealed. Actually, it was not long after Prohibition ended that Kennedy sold his company Somerset.
No.
Now, Joe actually drank little alcohol. He disapproved of what he considered a stereotypical Irish vice that he offered his sons $1,000 not to drink until they turned 21.
I wonder if that worked.
Probably. I mean, he ran that family, you know, iron fist.
Yeah, but they, you know, they probably snuck.
Oh, I'm sure they were sneaking booze.
Snuck it.
Especially in Teddy. Hey, Dad! Teddy.
Hey, Dad, look at me.
Teddy. Teddy, are you drunk at the dinner table again? No, Dad, are you drunk at the dinner table
Dad,
again?
Dad, I'm not drunk. I only had 7 drinks.
He was the only kid who made Long Island iced teas at school.
Like, sorry, Teach. I got to get a little hair of the dog. You got that blender?
Now, he invested his profits from alcohol into residential and commercial real estate in New York, the Le Pavilion restaurant, and the Hialeah Park racetrack in Hialeah, Florida. His most important purchase was a large office building in the country, Chicago's Merchandise Mart, which gave his family a grounding in that city and alliance with the Irish-American political leadership there. Now, his first major involvement in national politics was his support in 1932 of FDR's bid for the presidency, where he donated, loaned, and raised a substantial amount of money for the campaign. He sent leg breakers to, you know, collect, yeah. collect on debts. In 1934, Congress established the Independent Securities Exchange Commission, the SEC, to end irresponsible market manipulations and dissemination of false information about securities. Now in the 21st century, the SEC remains one of the most powerful government agencies. Its predecessor had been ineffective in 1933 and 34 as a part of another agency and the financial market was dying. Now, FDR named Joe to head the SEC to clean up of Wall Street. The New Deal attracted many of the nation's most talented young lawyers. Joe also appointed a hard-driving team with a mission for reform. Now, this team included William O. Douglas and Abe Fortas, who were later named to the U.S. Supreme Court. The SEC had four missions. First and foremost was to restore investor confidence in the securities market, which had collapsed on account of its questionability and the external threats supposedly posed by anti-business elements in the Roosevelt administration. Second, it had to get rid of the penny ante swindle based on false information, fraudulent devices, and get-rich-quick schemes. Third, and much more important than the frauds, the SEC had to end the million-dollar maneuvers in major corporations, whereby insiders with access to much better information about the company knew when to buy or sell their own securities. A crackdown on insider trading was essential. And finally, they had to set up a complex system of registration for all securities sold in America with a clear set of rules, deadlines, and guidelines that all companies had to follow. The main challenge faced by the young lawyers was drafting precise rules. The SEC succeeded in its four missions as Kennedy reassured the American business community that they would no longer be deceived and taken advantage of by Wall Street. He trumpeted for ordinary investors to return to the market and enable the economy to grow again. Joe's work as SEC chairman was widely praised on all sides as investors realized the SEC was protecting their interests. He left in 1935 to take over the Maritime Commission, which built on his wartime experience in running major shipyards. Now, Father Charles Coughlin was an Irish-Canadian priest near Detroit who became the most prominent Roman Catholic spokesman on political and financial issues in the 30s, with a radio audience that reached millions every week. Having been a strong supporter of Roosevelt since 32, in 34, Coughlin broke with the president, who became a bitter opponent of Coughlin's weekly anti-communist, anti-Semitic, far-right, anti-Federal Reserve, and isolationist radio talks.
Jesus.
He was the InfoWars of his day.
I guess.
I've actually heard about this guy. This guy is someone we should look into because this dude was like off the fucking rails.
Like worse than Alex Jones?
Yeah. I actually heard a look. I think it was Professor Buzzkill where I heard it. He had a little clip of one of his radio shows. And, ooh, this dude was sniffing something. Now, Roosevelt sent Kennedy and other prominent Irish Catholics to try to tone down Coughlin. Well, Coughlin swung his support to Huey Long in 35 and to William Lemke's Union Party in 36. Joe strongly supported the New Deal, although Father Conklin believed that the New Deal did not go far enough, and he believed that Franklin was a tool of the rich, and believed as early as 33 that Coughlin was becoming a very dangerous proposition as an opponent of the Roosevelt and an in-and-out demagogue. In 36, Kennedy worked with Roosevelt, Bishop Francis Spellman, and Cardinal Eugenio Pacelli, who later became Pope Pius XII, to shut Coughlin down. When Coughlin returned to the air in 1940, Kennedy continued to battle against his influence among the Irish Americans. Now, in 1938, Roosevelt appointed Kennedy as the United States ambassador to the court of St. James, London, basically. He was our ambassador to England.
Oh, boy.
Kennedy hugely enjoyed his leadership position in London high society, which stood in stark contrast to his relative outsider status in Boston. On May 6, 1944, his daughter Kathleen married William Billy Cavendish, the elder son of the Duke of Devonshire, who was the head of one of England's grandest aristocratic families.
Oh, boy.
Now, Kennedy rejected the beliefs that rejected the beliefs of Winston Churchill, that any compromise with Nazi Germany was impossible. Instead, Kennedy supported Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain's apparent policy of appeasement. So instead of following the bulldog, he followed the cheese-eating surrender monkey.
Yeah.
Now, through 1938, while the Nazi persecution of Jews in Germany intensified, Joe attempted to arrange a meeting with Adolf Hitler.
Of course he did.
Now, shortly before the Nazi aerial bombing of British cities began in September of 1940, Kennedy once again sought a personal meeting with Hitler without the approval of the Department of State in order to bring about a better understanding between the United States and Germany.
Of course.
Oh, Joe.
There's that show on Amazon Prime, that Hunters show.
I've seen the commercials for
it. It's freaking awesome.
Oh, I'm going to have to wait for that to come out on DVD or something.
It's freaking awesome.
Now, Joe also argued strongly against providing military and economic aid to England. But you're the ambassador, jackass.
No shit.
Democracy is finished in England. It may be here, he stated in the Boston Sunday Globe of November 10, 1940. With German troops having overrun Poland, Denmark, Norway, Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and France, and with daily bombings on Great Britain, Joe unambiguously and repeatedly stated his belief that this war was not about saving democracy from National Socialism or fascism.
Hmm.
In an interview with two newspaper journalists, Lewis M. Lyons of the Boston Globe and Ralph Coughlin of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Joe said, "It's all a question of what we do with the next 6 months. The whole reason for aiding England is to give us time. As long as she is in there, we will have time to prepare. It isn't that Britain is fighting for democracy. That is our debunk. She's fighting for self-preservation, just as we will if it comes to us.
I know more about the European situation than anybody else, and it's going to be up to me to see that the country gets it."
So I had to switch voices there because,
Because
at that moment, Joe was sounding like Tangerine Caligula.
Yeah.
Your name is caught on in some of our pages, man.
What's that?
Tangerine Caligula has caught on in some of our groups.
I am glad I coined that term.
His views were becoming inconsistent and increasingly isolationist. Now, British MP Josiah Wedgwood, first Baron Wedgwood, who himself had opposed British government's earlier appeasement policy, said of Joe, "We have a rich man, untrained in diplomacy, unlearned in history and politics, who is a great publicity seeker, who apparently is ambitious to be the first Catholic president of the U.S. In British government circles during the Blitz, Kennedy was widely disparaged as a defeatist. He retreated to the countryside during the bombings of London by German aircraft, at a time when the British royal family, the prime minister, government ministers, and other ambassadors chose to stay in London.
Mm.
Now, this prompted a member of Britain's foreign office to say, "I thought my daffodils were yellow until I met Joe Kennedy."
Shit.
The Luftwaffe's coming. I have a croquet game in the country. With some chowder.
Chowder.
Now, when the White House read his quotes, it became clear that Kennedy was completely out of step with FDR's policies. Kennedy was called home. FDR urgently needed his support to hold the Catholic vote and invited him to spend the night at the White House, unlike in Bill Clinton's time where he was running out the Lincoln Room. Now, Joe agreed to make a nationwide radio speech to advocate Roosevelt's re-election. FDR was pleased with the speech because, Nassau says, it successfully rallied reluctant Irish Catholic voters to his side, buttressed his claims that he was not going to take the nation into war, and emphasized that he alone had the experience to lead the nation in these difficult times. After FDR was re-elected, Kennedy submitted his resignation as ambassador.
Yeah.
Now, throughout the rest of World War II, relations between Kennedy and the Roosevelt administration remained tensed, especially when Joe Jr. vocally opposed President Roosevelt's unprecedented nomination for a third term, which began in 1941. So, because right before FDR went for a third term, nobody ever tried.
Mm-hmm.
And FDR is the only one who did four terms, and that's when Congress was like, all right, we need to pass an amendment from this shit happening again.
Yeah.
Because it was the fear of, you know, you could just keep running for the rest of your life.
I just saw a meme about that the other day about FDR and the terms.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it said, but...
Now, Joe may have wanted to run for president himself in 1940 or later. Now, having effectively removed himself from the national stage, Joe sat out of World War II on the sidelines. Joe stayed active in the smaller venues of rallying Irish Americans and Roman Catholic Democrats to vote for Roosevelt's re-election for a fourth term in 1944. Former Ambassador Kennedy claimed to be eager to help the war effort, but as a result of his previous gaffes, he was neither trusted nor invited to do so. Now, due to his philanthropy and a close friendship with Francis Spellman, Archbishop of New York, who later became Cardinal, during this time, Joe was invited or was invested as a Knight of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, an honor which at the time he shared with just a few dozen Americans. Now, with his ambitions to achieve the White House no longer viable, he held out great hope for his eldest son, Joseph Kennedy Jr., to seek the presidency. However, Joe Jr. had become a U.S. Navy bomber pilot and was killed over the English Channel while undertaking Operation Aphrodite, a high-risk new way to use heavy bombers to strike German missile sites in France. Now, this happened in 1944. Now, the intention was to use remote-controlled aircraft from which the pilot had bailed out after a piloted takeoff. Joe Jr.'s bomber exploded before he could bail out.
Oh, shit.
So, after grieving over his dead son, Joe Sr. then turned his attention to a second son, John, for a run for the presidency. After serving as a member of the House of Representatives beginning in 1946, and then a U.S. Senator beginning in 1952, the younger Kennedy entered the presidential election of 1916, as you know, he won it. Now, according to Harvey Clemmer, who served as one of Kennedy's embassy aides, Kennedy habitually referred to Jews as kikes or sheenies.
Oh, shit.
And, you know, we apologize for any of the Jewish faith who are listening to this right now. Now, Kennedy also told Clemmer that some individual Jews are all right, Harvey. Individual Jews are all right, Harvey, but as a race, they stink. They spoil everything they touch. Now, when Clemmer returned from his trip to Germany and reported the pattern of vandalism and assaults on Jews by Nazis, this is Kennedy's response. Well, they deserved it. They brought it on themselves, is his actual quote. So, now, Kennedy was also anti fiercely anti-communist as he was anti-Semitic, and Kennedy looked upon Adolf Hitler as a welcome solution to both of these world problems. Kennedy replied that he expected the Jew media in the United States to become a problem, and that Jewish pundits in New York and Los Angeles were already making noises contrived to set a march or set a match to the fuse of the world. God. Now, he said to a reporter, "It is true that I have a low opinion of some Jews in public office and in private life. That does not mean that I believe they should be wiped off the face of the earth. Jews who take an unfair advantage of the fact that theirs is a persecuted race do not help much. Publicizing unjust attacks upon the Jews may help to cure the injustice, but continually publicizing the whole problem only serves to keep it alive in the public mind."
Okay.
Yeah, right. Now,
so, read that again, that little bit about keeping it in the public mind.
"It is true that I have a low opinion of some Jews in public office and in private life. That does not mean that I believe they should be wiped off the face of the earth. Jews who take an unfair advantage of the fact that theirs is a persecuted race do not help much. Publicizing unjust attacks upon the Jews may help to cure the injustice, but continually publicizing the whole problem only serves to keep it alive in the public mind."
Yeah. That's,
Oh, right. That's a little bit far-fetched.
Yeah, exactly. That's basically like, shut up, black people. We don't need to hear about slavery anymore.
Right.
Because every time you mention it, it just keeps it in the public mind and everything.
Well, now we know Dick Nixon was anti-communist.
Yeah.
And in 1960, Kennedy approached Nixon saying, "Dick, if my boy can't make it, I'm for you for the presidential election this year." Now, he also sided with Senator Joseph McCarthy.
Who actually set up the two term? Was it Democrats that did that?
I don't know. I know it was normally presidents serve two terms. Some did one. Nobody went more than two.
I found that meme because it said the last time America had a democratic socialist, they had to enact term limits because he kept getting reelected over and over and over, because he served four terms. It says over and over and over, served four terms. I'm like, yeah, because people loved him so much, because he was doing such a good job.
Right. Now, Kennedy's final public appearance was with his wife and his son, Ted, in a filmed message to the country following the death of his son, Robert.
Before Ted started drinking?
Or probably when Ted was drinking.
This is what got Ted started drinking.
Right. Now, he died at his home in Hyannisport on November 18th, 1969, 2 months after his 81st birthday, having outlived three of his four sons and one of his five daughters. He was buried at Holywood Cemetery in Brookline, Massachusetts. Now, his widow Rose was buried next to him following her death in 1995, as was their daughter Rosemary in 2005. And that is Joe.
And was wrapped in a bunch of tinfoil, as are full-blooded Irish the world over. So they look like giant baked potatoes.
Right. That's how I'm doing it, folks.
Are you going to be wrapped in aluminum foil when you get buried?
Hell yeah. And I want everyone at my funeral wearing tin foil hats so that the so the government can read their brainwaves.
Oh, yeah, the deep state. You don't want the deep state to find your location.
Right. Fuck, I don't want my father to find my location. What are you talking about? Oh, did you see I put that picture of him up on Killers the other day?
No.
I'll show you when we go off. He was up in Wisconsin at my cousin's.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, they get to entertain him now because I don't want to... That dude's looking like the abolitionist John Brown every year, man. I'm waiting for him.
It's a one-state proximity alert.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's like your dad is one state away. You know, because doesn't he live in, like, Arizona or some shit?
Last we knew, somewhere in Wisconsin.
Well, no. I mean, didn't he come from, like, Arizona?
Yeah.
Wasn't he, like, living out there, like, last year or some shit?
Something like that.
Yeah, so now it's a... Oh, he's one state away, so there's a one state proximity alert.
All right, we're going to wrap this one up. If you're looking for us out there, we're on.
Crazy Incarnate is it within driving distance.
He is, right. That's why I'm going to Philly, so I can get away from it.
Yeah. So yeah, but that's in the direction of the president.
Only if he doesn't like the president. I don't know where he stands on Trump.
I don't know. We all know he loves Bill Clinton or loved Bill Clinton.
Well, he's got issues with every president. So.
Wanted to give Bill Clinton condoms and...
And not those were my condoms.
And I wonder how he feels about giving Bill Clinton condoms now.
Oh, true. We're on Anchor, all your major podcasting apps, and we're on Apple Podcasts. Brian, do your job, man. I remembered.
Oh.
I remembered before we started doing more recordings today.
Yeah.
We've got the Facebook page. Just find us there.
Just because you remembered this time doesn't
mean
you're not...
Don't worry, I'll forget next time.
Does not mean you are slowly slipping into senility.
Not yet.
Yeah. Well, yeah, not yet, anyway.
And for the Smartass Historian, I am Scotty J.
And I'm Jeff.
Catch you later, folks.
Bye.